Our luggage was placed in large leather saddle bags, as is customary in Tibet. A pack mule carried two small tents and our provisions. The distance was not great. One could easily accomplish the trip in 4 days. I intended, however, to travel very slowly so as not to miss anything of interest on my way, and above all, that I might absorb in body and spirit as much as possible of Tibet, whose heart I was at last about to penetrate, but probably might never see again. Since my first visit to Khorton Naima, I had met a son of the Lama sorcerer who sent ritualistic cakes flying through the air to punish his disobedient neighbors, and I had been invited, if circumstances permitted, to visit him. Tranglung, the village where he lived, was no more on the straight road leading from my hermitage to Shigatse than Khorton Naima, but as I have just said, I intended to profit by all opportunities of seeing interesting things that my adventure in Forbidden Land might bring me. We reached Tranglung at the end of the afternoon. The village was quite different from any that Tibetan settlers have built in the Himalayas. It was, indeed, surprising to find such a complete contrast at so short a distance. Not only the tall stone houses differed from the cottages made of wood with thatched roofs I had been accustomed to see in Sikkim, but the climate, the soil, the landscape, the people's cast of features and general look had changed. I was really in Tibet. We found the sorcerer in his oratory, a huge room without any windows, scantily enough lighted through the roof. Near him were several men to whom he was distributing charms which consisted in toys like small pig's heads, made of pink-colored clay and wrapped in woolen threads of different shades. The peasants listened with rapt attention to the Lama's endless instructions on the ways to use these objects. When they had gone, the householder Lama, with a gracious smile, invited me to take tea with him. A long conversation ensued. I was burning to ask my host about the flying cakes, but a direct question would have been against all rules of politeness. During the few days I remained there, I was told about a peculiar domestic drama and had the rare honor of being consulted by an authentic sorcerer. Here, as in a large number of families in central Tibet, polyandry was practiced. On the wedding day of the Lama's eldest son, his brothers' names had been mentioned in the marriage deed and the young girl had consented to take them all as husbands. As in most cases, at that time some of the bridegrooms were mere children who had, of course, not been consulted. They were, nevertheless, legally married. Now the sorcerer of Tranglung had 4 sons. I was not told what the second son thought about his partnership with his elder brother. He was away in journey and most likely all was right with him. The 3rd son, whom I knew personally, was also traveling somewhere. It was he who had upset the peace of the family. He was much younger than his 2 brothers, being only 25, and he obstinately refused to fulfill his conjugal duties toward the collective wife. Unfortunately for the lady, this purely nominal husband was far more attractive than the elder 2. Not only was he rather better looking than his brothers, but he surpassed them in social position, eloquence, learning, and maybe in various other accomplishments that I could not discover. While the 2 elders were but wealthy farmers, the 3rd brother enjoyed the prestige attached, in Tibet, to clergy. He was a Lama, and more than a common Lama. He was a so-called Naljorpa initiated in occult doctrines. He had the right to wear the 5-sided hat of the Tantric mystics and the white skirt of the Rispas, who are adepts in Tummo, the art of keeping warm without fire in even the coldest weather. Regarding Tummo, see Psychic Sports on page 122. It was this distinguished husband who refused to fulfill his part, and the offended wife could not resign herself to be disdained. What made the matter worse was that the young Lama courted a girl in one of the neighboring villages and meant to marry her. The law of the country permitted him to do so, but if he persisted in this marriage and thus broke up the unity of the family, the young husband would have to leave his father's house and establish a new home for his bride. The priestly son of my host, indeed, did not shrink from the responsibility, and even relied confidently on his earnings as a sorcerer to make that home comfortable. But by so doing, would he not be setting himself up as a rival to his father? Although the old lama did not express his thought in words, I could read in the expression of his face that he feared a competitor in that obstinate son who refused to please a healthy, sturdy woman of 40. Probably not too ugly. I could not dispute this point, for the wife's features were hidden under a thick coating of butter and soot that made her as black as a negress. What on earth is to be done? Groaned the aged mother of the family. I had no experience in such matters. Though I had met polyandrist ladies in the West, as a rule no family council was called in to settle the imbroglios that result from their affairs. And in my travels I had only been asked for advice by polygamous gentlemen whose homes had become a seat of war. Since polygamy is also legal in Tibet, I suggested that the young lama might be persuaded to bring his bride home. Luckily for me, I was then wearing the respected monastic robe, for only this prevented the jealous, disdained wife from throwing herself upon me. "Reverend lady," cried the old mother as she wept, "you do not know that our daughter-in-law wanted to send her servants to beat the girl and to disfigure her. We had a hard task to prevent her from doing so. Think of people of our rank doing such thing. We should be dishonored forever afterwards." I could find nothing more to say, so I remarked that it was time for my evening meditation and asked permission to retire to the oratory which the lama had courteously lent to me for the night. As I was leaving the room I noticed the youngest son, a lad of 18, the husband number 4. He was seated in a dark corner and looking at the common wife with a strange half-smile, as if he were saying, "Wait a little, old lady, I have worse things in store for you." During the following days I wandered idly from village to village, sleeping at night in the peasants' houses. I did not try to hide my identity as I was obliged to later on the road to Lhasa. No one here seems to notice that I was a foreigner, or at any rate, no one seems to attach any importance to the fact. My road passed the monastery of Patta which appeared to me immense compared with those of Sikkim. One of the ecclesiastic officials invited us to an excellent meal in a dark hall where we enjoyed the company of several monks. Nothing there, with the exception of the massive buildings several stories high, was entirely new to me. Nevertheless, I understood that Lamaism as I had observed it in Sikkim was only a pale reflection of that which exists in Tibet. I had vaguely imagined that beyond the Himalayas the country would become wild. But now I began to realize that on the contrary I was coming into touch with a truly civilized people. Among the various incidents of the journey, the Kai River, swollen by the rains and the melting snows, was difficult to ford in spite of the help of 3 villagers who took our horses across one by one. Beyond the village called Kimu extends a long tract of desert land. According to the description of our servant who knew the road well, I hoped to camp pleasantly near thermal springs, getting a hot bath and warm earth for bedding. A sudden storm compelled us to set up our camp hastily before reaching this desired paradise. First hail attacked us, then the snow began to fall so hard that it soon came nearly up to our knees. A neighboring brook overflowed into our camp. I had to spend the night fasting and standing up most of the time on the small island that was the only spot, under my tent, not invaded by the muddy water. So much for the comfortable sleep I had expected. At last, at a turning of the road where I had stopped to look at a drunken man wallowing in the dust, my eyes suddenly fell on a glorious vision. In the bluish gloaming, the enormous monastery of Tashilhunpo stood in the distance, a mass of white buildings crowned with golden roofs that reflected the last dim rays of the setting sun. I had reached my goal. A strange idea had grown up in my mind. Instead of looking for a shelter in one of the inns of the town, I sent my servant to the lama who was responsible for entertaining the monks, visitors or the native students from the Kham province. How could a foreign woman traveler, unknown to him, awaken his interest, and what reason could she have for requesting his good offices? I had not asked myself this question. I acted entirely on impulse and the result was excellent. The distinguished official sent a tripper to order 2 rooms for me in the only house next to the monastery. There I settled myself. The very next day, according to the protocol, the requests for an audience with the Tashi Lama were begun. I had to give details of my native country and satisfied them by saying that my birthplace was called Paris. Which Paris? Dash south of Lhasa there is a village called Phagri, that name being pronounced Peri. I explained that my Paris was a little farther away from the Tibetan capital and stood westward, but I insisted on the point that starting from Tibet, one could reach my country without crossing the sea and that, consequently, I was not a filing or stranger. This was a play upon the word filing, which literally means a continent over sea. I had stayed so long in the proximity of Shagats that it was impossible to be unknown there, and, moreover, the fact of having lived as a hermit made me somewhat famous in the country. An audience was immediately granted and the mother of the Tashi Lama invited me to be her guest. I went over every corner of the monastery and, to pay for my welcome, I offered tea to the several thousand monks living there. The number of years that have elapsed and the chances I have taken, since that time, to visit the large lamasseries, or even to dwell in them, have dulled my impressions, but when I went round Tashilhunpo I was deeply struck by everything I saw. A barbaric splendor reigned in the temples, halls, and palaces of the dignitaries. No description can give an idea of it. Gold, silver, turquoises, jade, were lavishly used on the altars, the tombs, the ornamented doors, the ritualistic implements and even on mere household objects for the use of wealthy lamas. Should I say that I admired this opulent display? No, for it seemed unrefined and childish, the work of powerful giants whose minds had not grown up. That first contact with Tibet would even have impressed me unfavorably if I had not had ever present before me the vision of its calm solitudes, and known that they conceal ascetic sages who spurn the vulgarities that are the insignia of grandeur in the eyes of the masses. The Tashi Lama was most kind to me every time I saw him and showered me with attentions. He knew quite well where my Paris was and pronounced the word France with a perfect French accent. My zeal for the study of Lamaism pleased him very much. He was willing to help my researches in any way. Why should I not stay in Tibet? He asked me. Why, indeed? Desire was not lacking, but I knew that however great and honored he was in the country, the gracious Grand Lama had not enough temporal power to obtain permission for me to live in Tibet. Nevertheless, if I had, at that moment, been as free of ties as I was when I undertook my journey to Lhasa, I might have attempted to avail myself, in some secluded spot, of the protection which was offered to me. But I had not foreseen such an offer. My luggage, notes, collections of photo negatives, why should one think these things important? Had been left behind, some in the care of friends in Calcutta, others in my hermitage. How many things remained for me to learn? How great was the mental transformation necessary to enable me to become, a few years later, a joyful tramp in the wilds of Tibet. While at Shagats, I met the masters who had educated the Tashi Lama, his professor of secular sciences and he who had initiated him into the mystic doctrines. I also came to know a contemplative mystic, the spiritual guide of the Tashi Lama, highly revered by him, who if we must believe the stories told about him, ended his life, a few years later, in a miraculous way. See Psychic Phenomena in Tibet, How Tibetans Explain Them on page 176. During my visit to Shagats, the temple that the Tashi Lama meant to dedicate to the future Buddha Maitreya, the Lord of Infinite Compassion, was nearing completion. I saw the huge image placed in a hall with galleries that allowed the devotees to circle around it on the ground floor on a level with the feet and successively ascending the first, second and third galleries, up to its belt, its shoulders and its head. 20 jewelers were setting the enormous ornaments that were to adorn the gigantic Maitreya. They were resetting the jewels presented by the ladies belonging to the nobility of Tsang, the mother of the Tashi Lama at their head, with the gift of all her sets of precious stones. I spent delightful days in the palaces of the Tashi Lama in Shagats and the neighborhood. I talked with men of widely different characters. The novelty of what I saw and heard, the special psychic atmosphere of the place, enchanted me. I have seldom enjoyed such blissful hours. At last the dreaded moment came. Taking with me books, notes, presents and the robe of a graduate lama that the Tashi Lama had bestowed on me as a kind of diploma of Dr. Honorai Kauzu of the Tashilhunpo University, I left Shigatsu, gazing sadly at the immense monastery as it disappeared behind the same turning of the road from which it had first appeared to me. I went on to Nathang to visit the largest of the printing establishments in Tibet. The number of engraved wooden plates used for the printing of the various religious books was prodigious. Set up on shelves, in rows, they filled a huge building. The printers, spattered with ink up to their elbows, sat upon the floor as they worked, while in other rooms monks cut the paper according to the size required for each kind of book. There was no haste, chatting and drinking of buttered tea went on freely. What a contrast to the feverish agitation in our newspaper printing rooms. From Nathang I sought out the hermitage of a Gomchen who had been good enough to send me an invitation. I found the anchorite's abode in a desolate place on a hill, near the Lake Motong. It consisted of a spacious cave, to which one room after another had been added, till it looked like a small fort. The present Gomchen had succeeded his master who himself had succeeded his own spiritual father, famous as a wonder worker. Gifts of devotees to three generations of Lama magicians had led to the accumulation, in the hermitage, of a good number of objects affording comfort, and life could be passed there quite pleasantly, that is, from the point of view of a Tibetan, born in the wilds and accustomed since his youth to live as the disciple of an anchorite. Such was the case of my host. He had never been to Lhasa nor to Shigatse, nor travelled anywhere in Tibet and knew nothing of the world outside his cave. His master had lived there for more than 30 years, and when he died the present hermit had walled himself in. By walled in, one must understand that one door only gave access to the hermitage enclosure, and this door the Lama never approached. Two lower rooms under the rock, kitchen, storeroom and servants' quarter altogether, opened on an inner courtyard closed in, on the side which gave on to the precipice, by a high wall. Above these rooms an upper cave was the private apartment of the Lama, which was reached by a ladder and a trap door in the floor. This chamber stood on a small terrace, also closed by walls, so the recluse could take a little exercise or sun himself without being seen by anyone outside and without himself seeing anything but the sky overhead. The anchorite mitigated the severity of his seclusion by receiving visitors and chatting with them, but he added to its austerity by never lying down to sleep, spending the nights in a gamti. There exist, in Tibet, special seats which are called gamti or gomti, square boxes, each side being about 25 or 30 inches long and one of the sides being higher to form the back of the seat. At the bottom of the box a cushion is placed on which the ascetic sits cross-legged. Often he does not allow himself to lie against the back of the seat, and in order to support his body, either while sleeping or during long meditation, he uses the meditation rope. It is a sash usually made in woolen cloth, which one passes under the knees and behind the nape of the neck, on with which one encircles the knees and the back. Many Gomchens spend days and nights in that way, without reclining or stretching their limbs to sleep. They doze sometimes but never fall fast asleep, and except during these short periods of drowsiness, they do not stop their meditation. I had several interesting conversations with the hermit and then I turned back towards the frontier. The British resident at Gangtok had already sent a letter by peasants from Sikkim ordering me to leave Tibetan soil. I had not obeyed because I wanted to end my trip as I had planned it, but now I had accomplished my object, and as I had foreseen the consequences of a prolonged incursion on the forbidden territory, I was ready to bid farewell to the Himalayas. A second letter commanding me to leave the vicinity of the Tibetan border found me already on the road to India en route for the Far East. Chapter 3, A Famous Tibetan Monastery. Once more I have crossed the Himalayas, proceeding downward to India. It is sad to leave the bewitching region where during several years I have lived a most fantastic and captivating life, though, wonderful as this entrance house of Tibet proved to be, I know that I am far from having obtained even a glimpse of all the strange mystic doctrines and practices which are hidden from the profane in the hermitages of the land of snow. My journey to Shagats has also revealed me the scholastic Tibet, its monastic universities, its immense libraries. How many things are left for me to learn? And I am leaving. I go to Burma and spend days of retreat on the Sagain Hills with the Kamatangs, the contemplative monks of one of the most austere Buddhist sects. I go to Japan where I dive into the calm of the Tofokuji, a monastery of the Zen sect which, for centuries, has collected the intellectual aristocracy of the country. I go to Korea. Panyalan, the monastery of wisdom concealed in the heart of the forest, opens its door to me. When I went there to beg temporary admittance, heavy rains had washed the path away. I found the Panyalan monks busy repairing it. The novice sent by his abbot to introduce me stopped before one of the workers as muddy as his companions, bowed respectfully and said a few words to him. The digger, leaning on his spade, looked at me intently for a while, then nodded his consent and began to work again, without taking any more notice of me. He is the head of the hermitage, my guide told me. He is willing to give you a room. The next day when I returned to Panyalan, I was led to a completely empty cell. My blanket spread on the floor was to be my couch, while my dressing case could be used as a table. Yongden was to share the room of a young novice of his age, which, excepting for a few books on a shelf, was as little furnished as mine. The daily routine included 8 hours of meditation divided in 4 periods of 2 hours, 8 hours of study and manual work, 8 hours devoted to sleep, meals and recreation according to individual tastes. Each day, a little before 3 a.m., a monk went round the houses, striking a wooden instrument to waken his brothers. Then, all met in the assembly room, where they sat in meditation facing the wall. Diet was truly ascetic, rice and some boiled vegetables without any flavoring. Even the vegetables were often missing and the meal consisted of plain rice alone. Silence was not compulsory as it is amongst the Trappist, but the monks seldom spoke. They did not feel the need of talking nor of spending their energy in outward manifestations. Their thoughts remained fixed on secret introspections and their eyes had the inward gaze of the Buddha's images. I go to Peking. I live in Plings, formerly an imperial mansion, now a Buddhist monastery. It is situated next to the large Lamaist temple and near the stately temple of Confucius, several miles distant from the legations. There, Tibet calls to me again. For years I have dreamt of faraway Kambum without having dared hope I would ever get there. Yet the journey is decided. I will cross the whole of China to reach its northwestern frontier into Tibetan land. I join a caravan composed of 2 rich lamas and their respective retinues, who are returning to Amdo, a Chinese trader of the remote Kansu province with his servants, and a few monks and laymen who are glad to benefit from the protection that numbers ensure on the unsafe roads. The journey is most picturesque. Besides other incidents, my traveling companions supply abundant matter for amazement. One day, the gigantic head of our caravan entertains some Chinese harlots at the inn where we have put up. Slender and short, clad in pale green pants and pink coats, they enter the lama's room like a family of Tom Thumbs going into the ogre's den. The lama is Ngagspa, a follower of the very heterodox sect of the magicians, scarcely belonging to the clergy, and a married man. A harsh and noisy bargaining takes place with the door wide open. The cynical, yet candid terms of the borderer of Kokon or wilderness are translated into Chinese by his imperturbable secretary interpreter. Finally, $5 are accepted as honorarium, one of the dolls stays overnight. Our libertine companion is also hot-tempered. Another day he quarrels with a Chinese officer. The soldiers of a neighboring post invader are in, guns in hand. The lama calls his retainers, who arrive with their own guns. The innkeeper falls prostrate at my feet beseeching me to intervene. With the help of the Chinese trader, a member of our traveling party, who knows Tibetan and acts as my interpreter, I succeed in convincing the soldiers that it is beneath their dignity to pay the least attention to the stupid actions of a barbarian from the Kokon or wilds. Then I remonstrate with the Lama against a man of his rank compromising himself with vulgar soldiers. Peace is restored. I become acquainted with civil war and robbery. I endeavor to nurse wounded men left without help. One morning I see a bunch of heads, those of newly beheaded robbers, hung above the door of our inn. That sight arouses philosophical thoughts about death in my placid son, which he quietly expounds to me. The road ahead of us is blocked by the fighting troops. I think I shall be able to avoid the vicinity of the battles by going to a town named Tung Chau, situated several miles away from the direct road to San Fu. The day after my arrival, Tung Chau is besieged. I could watch storming enemies climbing the city walls on high ladders, while defenders hurled stones down on them. I seemed to be living in an ancient picture depicting the wars of olden times. I escape from the besieged town during a tempest when the army remains sheltered on the other side of the walls. My cart rushes madly through the night. We arrive at the shore of a river beyond which we expect to be in safety. We call the ferryman. For answer, shots are fired at us from the other bank. I have an amusing remembrance of a tea party with the governor of Shinsi. The enemy surrounds the city. Tea is served by soldiers with guns on their shoulders and revolvers in their belts, ready to resist an attack that may occur at any minute. Yet, the guests talk calmly with that exquisite and apparently serene courtesy which is one of the fruits of the old Chinese education. We discuss philosophical questions. One of the officials speaks French perfectly and acts as my interpreter. Whatever the feelings of the governor and his party may be in this tragic situation, their faces remain smiling. The conversation around the tea table is that of literati enjoying the intellectual game of exchanging subtle thoughts in a dispassionate way. How wonderfully refined and civilized are the Chinese, and how lovable, in spite of the faults that can be found in them. I came out, at last, from the troubled area. I am in Amdo, settled in the precinct of the Pejai Lama's palace, in the Kambum Monastery. Again, I plunge into a Tibetan life. Salutation to the Buddha. In the language of the gods and in that of the Las Comma 61. Snake Demi gods who live in the lakes and the ocean and are said to be the owners of fabulous wealth. 61 in the language of the demons, and in that of the men, in all the languages which exist, I proclaim the doctrine. A few lads stand on the flat roof of the assembly hall. They have hastily recited the liturgic formula and, simultaneously, lift the conches to their lips. Each of them take turn at breathing, while his companions continue to blow. And so is produced an uninterrupted bellowing whose sonorous waves, rising and falling in successive crescendi and diminuendi, spread over the still sleeping monastery. Above the peristyle of the hall, the young novices, wrapped in the clerical toga, are silhouetted on the bright starry sky like a row of unearthly dark beings who have alighted to call the dead from their slumbers. And, truly, the silent Gompa with its many low-roofed whitewashed houses appears, in the night, as a vast necropolis. The musical summons dies away. Moving lights appear through the windows of the princely Garbas 62 and noises arise from the Tashas 62. Grand Lama's mansions. 63 squatting around them. Doors 63. Houses of ordinary monks. Open, a hurried stamping of feet is heard in all the streets and avenues of the monastic city. The lamas are going to the morning assembly. As they reach the precincts of the hall, the sky grows pale, the day breaks. Taking off their felt boots which they leave outside, piled here and there, each of them hastens towards his place. In large monasteries, the gathering monks number several thousands. A strange, shabby, ill-smelling crew, offering a strange contrast to the sumptuousness of the gold brocade vests worn by the dignitaries and the jeweled cloak and rod of office of the Tsogs Chenshungo, the elected ruler of the Gompa. Hanging from the high ceiling, from the galleries and against the tall pillars, scrolls of painting show countless Buddhas and deities, while a host of other worthies, saints, gods and demons, may be vaguely discerned on the frescoes which decorate the walls of the dark edifice. At the bottom of the hall, behind rows of butter lamps, shine softly the gilded images of former Grand Lamas and the massive silver and gold reliquaries which contain their ashes or mummified bodies. A mystic atmosphere envelops men and things, veiling all vulgar details, idealizing the attitudes and the faces. Whatever knowledge one may have acquired regarding the shortcomings of many of the monks assembled there, the sight of the assembly itself is most impressive.